Our feature guest this morning is the First Lady of the Press in Washington. For more than 50 years, Helen Thomas, now in her 80s, has reported in Washington, the bulk of those years, as a White House correspondent. She's covered every president since John F. Kennedy. Her careers included a long stint as White House bureau chief for the wire agency UPI. She then became a columnist for the Hearst Corporation's King Features Syndicate. She's written four books, including Thanks for the Memories, Mr. President, Wits and Wisdom from the Front Row of the White House. Now that's an apt title, because it was from the front row that she delivered the first question at press conferences for so many years. And also for so many years ended with the tagline, Thank you, Mr. President. Her latest book, Watchdogs of Democracy? The Waning Washington Press Corps and How It Failed the Public, is perhaps indicative of her mood at this stage of her career, both in regard to the presidency of George W. Bush and the performance of the White House Press Corps covering it. Helen Thomas joins me now on the line from Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can we start with this latest president? And do you know, I haven't toted them up. How many would it be? Do you know off the top of your head?
Nine.
This ninth and latest president that you've covered, George W. Bush, an administration which pretty much cold-shouldered you, and a president who you reportedly described, perhaps not realizing it would be reported, as the worst in American history. Was that your honest assessment of this presidency?
Well, that was my early assessment, and it remains.
Why?
Because I think that I cannot think of one redeeming feature. I think anyone who would want war and deliberately take this country into war under falsehoods cannot exactly be put on a pedestal. I want our leaders to understand where they are, what they're doing, and have some sense of humanity. I mean, we have been disgraced by torture, we've been disgraced by everything that has been tied to this war. We have killed thousands of innocent people, bombed them. And to this moment, the leaders cannot explain why. One motivating reason, the only reason you go to war is when you are attacked. That's under international law. So we are illegal and immoral and unconscionable.
You've covered presidents during the Vietnam era. You covered the Nixon White House. Mm-hmm. And yet your assessment is on this administration.
Well, I was pretty tough on them, too, but they had some other sides, believe me. Johnson was magnificent on the domestic side. He ran through in the first 2 years on the tailwind of the Kennedy assassination, Medicare, the Civil Rights Act, voting rights for blacks for the first time in the South, federal aid to education at all levels, from Head Start for preschoolers to scholars, to scholarships and child and maternal health, national parks, public housing.
And Nixon?
Nixon went to China. He did, too, tried for some detente with the Soviet Union. And he did some things on the environment that were good.
He also, it is argued, although some within his administration, potentially prolonged the Vietnam War.
Pardon me?
He also, it is argued, or some within his administration, prolonged the Vietnam War.
Oh, no question about it. He promised, he said when he came into power, when he was elected in 1968, that he had a plan to end the war. 4.5 years later, we were still bombing hell out of Hanoi. So there's no question there was a lot of deception there, and he didn't want to be the first president, he said, to lose a war, as did Johnson, but we lost. We left Vietnam by our fingertips, clinging to helicopters.
Quite literally. You took on the administration, this administration, over the proposed war in Iraq before other White House correspondents did. What is your assessment of the press corps' coverage of the pre-war and early war Bush White House?
My colleagues let the country down. They gave up their one weapon, which is skepticism. I mean, they took all of these falsehoods in stride, and even when they knew there was it was so questionable, they didn't ask the questions. They thought they bought this whole business. It was going to be 4 days, a cakewalk. put on their trench coats, get embedded for 4 days, come home and live happily ever after and be great foreign correspondents. I know that's a very ruthless assessment, but they didn't remember Vietnam. They didn't know you don't go thousands of miles away to kill people in their own country or to get one man.
Why didn't they ask the questions at the outset?
Well, the fear card was played very heavily. I mean, 9/11, after 9/11, everyone started pulling their punches. They didn't want to be called. They didn't want to ask tough questions. This is my belief, because they didn't want to be called un-American, unpatriotic. So they remained silent when they should have been questioning very strongly, and the administration got away with it.
If misinformation or inaccurate information is put forward, as was the case in the weapons of mass destruction, some of the pronouncements there,
and ties to Al-Qaeda, and a threat from a third world country to the world's only major superpower.
So where does the responsibility lie in respect of misinformation? Those who provide it or those who report it?
Truth took a holiday on both sides, but I think it behooves the press to keep always pressing. And you can't always expect the leaders to tell the truth because they're trying to defend themselves, their own actions, and so forth. But it's up to the reporter not to seek popularity, but to try to find out the truth.
You describe it in your book as the waning Washington Press Corps. Does that mean that things have changed, that this is a performance below where the press has been in earlier times?
No question about it. But I do think they're coming out of their coma now. I think the Katrina hurricane was devastating, and they seem to have been unleashed by their corporate heads in New York or whatever. They started asking important questions, started showing some emotion. They were allowed to, and to question the administration.
How is the press corps managed? And I come back to Nixon because it's hard to see officials or indeed press staff being more blatantly difficult in their handling of the press than in his era. How does that compare with now?
Well, I think that after Watergate, the very fact that two Washington Post reporters were able to uncover this, by the time the scandal had really forced the resignation of President Nixon, Washington Post had 18 reporters on the story, and so did the New York Times. So it was a big story and so forth. And after that, reporters who were at the White House and couldn't do the real investigative work, but nevertheless were somewhat cowed and shamed in a sense, they realized that they should have been tougher, and they did get much tougher. They were very, very, they learned. It was an arena. It was no longer the White House press room. It was the lion's den after they realized how they had defaulted.
But there is a pattern here, is there not, that there's a late entry to the game and then the press trying to make up for its earlier absences, if you like.
Well, we're not supposed to be prosecutors, you know, in that respect. We certainly are to search for the truth, try to ask the important questions, and to make the leaders accountable. We're not supposed to have a dictatorship. We don't have one-man rule. We have to make the leaders explain and be accountable for what they do, especially since they do it in our name.
You mentioned the White House Press Corps having a slightly different role, and that's very interesting because it was the investigative work of non-White House reporters that...
Well, that's much easier for them to be on the outside.
So is that...
Calling up people all day and so forth, but not on when you're on a wire service, as I was with UPI. You're on a body watch. When the president goes out in public, you go out in public and so forth. So you're very different on a breaking news.
But when we look at the quality of information that some journalists ran in respect of the Iraq and the weapons of mass destruction evidence, etc., it did not match the quality of information that Watergate got from very senior, or a very senior official.
Well, the war is still going on, but books are being written and have been written, and some of this is pretty astounding, that how we were had.
What I'm getting to is whether it is harder now to get those sources, to get information, to get people prepared to act however you view their actions in the public interest by using the press.
I think it's more difficult when there's a war going on. I think you'll have fewer whistleblowers per se because they feel they're jeopardizing the troops and they shouldn't open their mouths. So I think it is more difficult. But in the end, I mean, the truth will come out. This is one of the most secretive administrations that I've ever covered. All administrations are secretive. All presidents think they own information that should be in the public domain. Everyone is secretive in that sense, but these people are more so. And wartime gives them a much greater excuse of national security.
In terms of the White House press corps, you made the point, the distinction, that that is about putting the questions to the president specifically, and I think I'm hearing you saying that that is happening now. But what happened in terms of your own treatment in the early days of the Iraq War when you were questioning President Bush over his decision?
Persona non grata. I'll survive. I didn't go into this business, and neither did you, I hope, to win a popularity contest. I feel my job is to ask the questions and let the chips fall where they may, and I don't expect to be kid gloved or anything.
But they didn't take your questions anymore, right? For how long?
No, it's been a year at least now.
Since you were last asked a question.
Last time I asked the president, what is the real reason you went to war? He said, the Taliban. I said, I'm talking about Iraq. He said, 9/11. I said, I'm talking about Iraq. So I never did get an answer. I think because the answer that we went to war, maybe same way with Australia and so forth, leaders, is that whatever the reason, it's not acceptable, whatever it was.
Come back to how you were...
We were not attacked.
Come back to where I started, though, which is your being ostracized. To what extent did that affect your ability to do your job?
Oh, no. Well, it didn't at all. The fact that I can't ask the president a question doesn't deter me. I'm always keep hoping that the other reporters will ask him, and I go to the briefings, White House briefings, and I pull their chain every day.
And is that what it's about now, pulling the chains?
It means that I'm very tough on them and ask the questions, and they are committed to be stand up there and try to answer some. And some of the answers, of course, don't parse, but there we are.
You're a self-declared liberal, which I think translates in New Zealand's probably to having a left-leaning political bent. It has a slightly different meaning, the word liberal, in New Zealand. But how much has that influenced your reporting and commentary over the years?
I write a public opinion column. I'm allowed to think for myself.
And how much can and should personal opinion influence political commentary?
I hope it influences a lot of people.
What about reporting?
But I'm not running for anything. I would like them to understand why people think it's wrong to torture.
Does the mainstream U.S. press corps demonstrate a political bias one way or the other?
They do. If you work for a wire service, I worked for a wire service, UPI, for 57 years. I was never accused of slanting anything. But I didn't bow out of the human race. I permitted myself to think, to care, to believe, but it didn't get in my copy. And I was never accused of any bias. Although everyone knew how I felt, I wrote the story straight, which is very easy to do.
I'm speaking to Helen Thomas, long-serving White House correspondent. And I'd like to go back now. It's 21 minutes past 10 on Radio New Zealand National. I'd like to go back now to your early life, if you would. You were a trailblazer as a woman in political journalism. How did your reporting career begin?
I saw my byline in the high school newspaper, and I was hooked for life. My ego swelled, and I said, this is it. I started working on the school paper. I loved the ambiance. I loved the sense of independence that I could be nosy all my life.
How did you make it happen, though? Because this was well before the era of there being many women reporters.
Well, I had a wonderful, wonderful parents who couldn't read or write, but they made me understand that I was free to do anything I wanted to do in life and could.
And so how did you break into the business, though?
Well, I went to Washington during the tail end of World War II and looked for a job. By this time, they were drafting every young man who had a pulse. If he was breathing, he was going to World War II, or he was being drafted. So slots opened up for women that had never been so before. There've been women reporters for 150 years, but very few and far between.
When you went to...
I found a job with UPI.
Mm. The wire service in those days, antiquated.
United Press then, and then it merged with International News Service. So,
but the wire service in those days, a very different business from the computerized beast it is today.
That's right.
What was it? What were you doing every day? What was the reality of it?
Covering Washington, covering Justice Department, covering the health and education, welfare, all the tricky track and so forth. I went to the White House in 1961.
And the president there was John F. Kennedy. Did you cover his campaign, in fact?
Part of it, the tail end.
Your views on Kennedy?
The most inspired, my favorite president. He reached for the stars. He told us we could do anything. We could even go to the moon in a decade. Did it, but he didn't live to see it. Created the Peace Corps, signed the first nuclear test ban treaty, inspired young people to go into public service, told them that it could be the crown of their career.
Had he lived his life out and faced all the hard things that come to any president, would he have had that same legacy?
Yes, even more so. I think he grew in office, which not all presidents do. He learned from his mistakes. He learned from the Bay of Pigs to the Cuban Missile Crisis. That was a quantum leap in foreign policy, what you learn. He stepped back from the brink, as did Nikita Khrushchev. Both had been in war. Both cared about humanity, and both knew they had arsenals, nuclear arsenals, to blow up the world. They each stepped back.
What you're saying is there is substance and not just what was so obvious about John Kennedy, which was his charm and his political abilities.
That's right. He had depth, and he believed that we all had the greater possibilities. He said there's a universe out there that we have to explore. He kept learning, and he believed in education strongly, so he grew.
Who would you pick then as you work through these, we've mentioned Nixon and so forth, as you work through these nine presidents, who else stood out to you as perhaps the makers eras?
Lyndon B. Johnson for his contribution on the domestic side. He moved the mountain. I mean, he understood people's needs. He wanted to lay a foundation beyond which people in our country don't starve, lack for medicine, education, shelter.
And others?
And he was there. But, of course, Vietnam was his denouement.
Mm.
Jimmy Carter put human rights as the centerpiece of his foreign policy. He's won the Nobel Peace Prize. He continues to work for peace. He is in total demand all over the world to solve disputes because both sides trust him. So he made a tremendous contribution, foreign policy.
If we look at the modern presidents, Ronald Reagan is a character who tends to polarize. What is your assessment of his era?
Moved our country to the right. There was a Reagan revolution, social Darwinism. Can't do it. Tough. He was really out to destroy organized labor. At the same time, he took into he worked on building up an arms race with the Soviet Union, which was down on its uppers and falling apart economically. And so I would say from that aspect, he was the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of the Cold War. But at every president since World War II has had the same foreign policy, which was really to be in contention with communism. And at the same time, they kept their powder dry, basically, which was good.
Was he not, in many ways, a breakthrough in respect of his relationship with Russia and with the détente, if you like, in the Cold War with Russia?
I don't call it that. It was the same foreign policy, except that Russia was really falling apart, and the arms race probably was the last straw.
George Bush, the first then, obviously, you've
and
covered...
Anyway, in fighting the Soviet Union, we kept our powder dry. We didn't do it with the barrel of a gun, basically, although there were some wars, of course. We did it through exchange students, exchange teachers, the Pope, blue jeans, rap music, the voice of America. We spread the ideas. We were lucky enough to have Gorbachev open the window a little.
In respect, then, of George Bush the First, you've observed father and son. Compare and contrast.
Well, George Bush First understood foreign policy. He understood the limitations also of even a superpower. And foreign policy was his forte, I think. He was not great on the domestic side, but he knew enough in the first Gulf War not to go to Baghdad. He said, of all things, can you believe it? He said there would be a civil war, that a religious war, and so forth. And, of course, the highway of death also kept him from it, which was where we were shooting down everybody who had their hands up trying to surrender, the Iraqis, at the end of that war. And that would have not played well in America.
Is there not the theory, though, that in some ways George Bush II's presidency is about completing the uncompleted work of his father's era?
What is uncompleted? To go into someone's country and conquer it and say this is a big victory? What is the goal? I mean, what do you mean completed?
Well, the same...
I know you're not saying it. Everybody else says it.
Well, the same characters involved, many of the same players.
So the job to do, well, it isn't our job to wipe out people in their own country. That is horrifying. It's brutal, it's cruel, it's unfair, unjust.
Let's keep working through this extraordinary modern era. And the other one, of course, is Bill Clinton. I'm very interested in your take on his presidency.
Well, I think he did a lot of good in terms of the search for peace in the Middle East, Northern Ireland, the Balkans, and so forth. But I think he could have done more. And I think he will not wind up on Mount Rushmore. He lost his chance for greatness. We have to take more chances than he did.
Keep going on that. What did he fail to do that might have earned him?
He had a total universal health care plan, for one thing. Instead, they had some Pavlovian recipe, which obviously didn't work and couldn't work, easily shot down by the drug companies and by the AMA, the medical people, and so forth, who didn't want universal health care. That, among other things, but a lot of other things where he could have taken his chances, and just depends on what you want to accomplish as president. If you want to accomplish re-election, I suppose you do pull in your horns.
As you look back over these nine presidents, what stood out to you about them as people? Did you have much personal access to them?
Did I have much what?
Personal access to them.
Oh, you know, you have your nose against the window pane. The personal access is you see them once and cover them and so forth. But there's a big distance between really knowing them, except you know them by their actions and by their words and whether they live up to what they say they are and so forth. So you make judgments all the time.
You were on Air Force One, I think, when you did the China trip with Nixon. Have I got that right?
Pardon me?
You were on Air Force One, I think, when you did the China trip with Nixon back in 72. Did he have any contact with the press, as modern presidents would do, wander down and have a chat or not?
Oh, sure, they do. And that it was a very, very exciting trip, probably one of the most that I ever had in covering the White House, because we had a 20-year hiatus of no relations, no diplomatic relations with China. The average American knew very little about what was happening in China. New Zealanders knew much more. CIA knew something. People living in Hong Kong, India, and so forth knew some of the transformation, incredible transformation of China into a communist society. But the average American didn't really know that much. So it was like landing on the moon for the reporters who went there. Everything was a story. How they looked, what they wore, what they ate, so forth. It was a gold mine for a reporter.
And come back to the contact with presidents then. You have made it very clear throughout this whole interview what you see as your role. And it's sure as heck not hobnobbing and chatting with them, right?
I don't... I would hobnob if I had the chance. It's better to get to know them. I believe that's okay. I think you it's very important to know who has the power to push the button and blow up the world.
It's interesting that, because I'm thinking of some of the big media magnates who did have close access to the presidents, the likes of your Phil Grahams running the Washington Post back in Kennedy's era in particular. What role the relationship between those senior media owners and editors and the various White Houses?
I don't think a real journalist can be co-opted or bought in that sense. I think the more you know, the better off you are.
So what? The fact that there may have been close personal contact and discussion of policy between media owners or senior editors is not a problem?
Me.
It's okay?
Especially if they can tell us what they learned.
In terms of the powers and the way Washington operates these days, we've looked at the press, and I guess it's limited powers in many ways. In terms of the lobby system, which has been very much under scrutiny in many years, has that got worse, if you like? Has it got out of control?
It's very powerful, I would say. Every, you know, special interest who will pay to promote their causes. But I don't think it's out of control. It probably could be much more regulated, but I don't think that is the main fault of our system right now. I think secrecy is... I think we should know almost everything, maybe not some top national security secret, but everything else we should know. And what is being done, as I say, in our name.
Well, will there ever again be a president who tape records every conversation he has in his office, isn't it? Possibly not.
I hope so. Who knows? We might find out they all tape record. But so far, I think they're playing it very cool. Anyway, they say enough to appall you.
On record.
Oh, my goodness.
Let me ask you for some predictions from your long experience.
Don't ask me who's going to win the election, because I don't know.
Who's going to...
The ball is very murky.
Are you a disciplined reporter who only ever reports on what they see and not speculates on what they haven't yet seen?
Not when I write an opinion column. I can go for broke.
Why won't you speculate? Is it just too tight?
Well, I think too many are running now, and I don't think it's so fluid, if I can use that word. I don't believe there is a sure end yet.
Is this on the Democrat side, or are you...
Either side. I don't think the Republicans have a prayer. Not if they continue on the road they are, and I certainly don't think, unless there's a miraculous turnaround. I don't see how a Republican can get elected.
So it's down to who wins
the
nomination.
But on the other hand, I'm very prejudiced on that score.
I think we've detected that. In terms of the issue, then, in your view, it depends who wins the Democrat nomination.
Well, I think that it's coming down to Hillary Clinton and to Obama, Barack.
Mm. Which means your first black or your first woman president, does either really matter?
Well, I think that it shows that diversity has finally come into its own in the U.S., and it'll be very interesting.
Helen, I can only imagine, with an indication of what wire agencies are like and an indication of what political seats of power are like, that you've done a little bit work all these years. Is that true? Do you ever regret committing an entire life to this the way you have?
Hell no. I love my job. Don't you love yours?
I've got to be honest with you. I intend to retire before I'm in my 80s.
Well, I know what you're hinting at. I love my job. I want to die with my boots on. Is there anything wrong with that?
I think
Why do I have to apologize for being alive?
You don't have to apologize for being alive. I'm just curious, will you ever retire, or is it just too much fun?
I love my work, and I love being a part of the whole scheme of things. I mean, you can participate in society. You feel you're making a contribution when you're informing people. How can a democracy work otherwise?
I thank you so much for being with us today. That is Helen Thomas. These days, a syndicated newspaper columnist with the Hearst Corporation's, what's the name of it, King Features Syndicate, and for many years, bureau chief for the wire agency UPI. A woman who's seen and certainly passed opinion on 9 US presidents.